some of you know Terry Fair very well, and others will not. Terry was a member here when I arrived in 1996, and we were doing a course on the goddesses, I think, the following year, maybe. Rise Up and Call Her Name, yes. It was quite interesting. Lots of circle dances and chanting. And anyway, Terry is a psychologist with the federal penitentiary system and has recently returned to Regina, and also does many other things as well. And today, Terry will give us the first in a four-part series that explores the manifestation of spirit. Others will be about compassion and a couple of other things which Terry can tell us about. Now I'm going to also cue up a couple of some slides here that'll be carrying on. So if Terry, if you'd like to come forward and join us, that would be great.
Good morning. I've been looking forward to this since September, so I hope it isn't a letdown for anybody. But I gave this talk, this series of talks, once before, and I think I should kind of explain that. I come from a Mennonite family. And all four of my grandparents and all, 16 of my great-grandparents were Mennonites. And the Mennonite culture is deeply ingrained in my character, my personality, and my sense of values. So and the Mennonites are basically Anabaptists, and Anabaptists are Christians. So I see a lot of my life from through that particular lens. And so the first time I gave this talk, I was in fact attending a Mennonite church. Now I have to say that while I was doing that, while I was giving this talk, I was feeling decidedly Unitarian. But when I went to look at the talk again and say, okay, well, I'm presenting now to a group of Unitarians, and it just really felt kind of Menno to me. So what I want to remind you of this morning is that some of the principles, the sources upon which we rely, the sources of wisdom from which we draw our teachings and our understandings in the Unitarian tradition are many and varied. And so you will hear in my talk this morning some references to God. And you will also hear a biblical reference or two. And I just want you to be clear that just because it's coming out of something Christian doesn't mean that it isn't found elsewhere. If you look, you'll find most of this stuff in every religion around the world. And that's the really cool thing about love. Well, one of the really cool things about love. The other thing that happened is that after I committed to this and we decided I would do this on a solstice, or close to the solstice, I heard a rumor that some people were hoping I would talk about solstice and the meaning of solstice. And so I'm going to slide into that kind of gently. Every religious tradition around the world, or pretty much every religious tradition around the world, has some sort of celebration around the 20th of December. Christians have Christians have, actually Muslims have Muhammad's birthday. They celebrate it a little bit later, but it's sort of generally this time of year. We celebrate the solstice. So the ancient pagans, our ancestors, who lived in the northern climates, became very frightened every year because the sun would start to disappear. And that meant, of course, if you didn't have any sun, you would have no crops, you would have no food. It would mean the end of the human race as they knew it. And so they would have celebrations to bring back the light. The Christians draw on that. Let's bring back the light in the form of the baby Jesus. And in my view of the world, and it's only my view, I think that that symbolizes love, the return of love and light into our lives. And as you know, the Buddhists will say everything kind of goes like this anyway. So we have that flow of life. Things get dark and then they get light again. And so now we're moving into a season where we really have to think about some of us have to really think about being happy at this time of year, because it's so dark and it's so dismal. Some of us have to work hard at getting up in the morning because it's so dark. And so we celebrate the darkness as a time to go within and examine, do some self-examination, but we also celebrate the return of the light and the return of love. So, with that preamble, all the caveats, I think I got all the caveats down, I'd like to start my presentation. So, love is a small word. Love is a four-letter word. If you listen carefully, you will hear people use the word love as both a verb and a noun. And its derivatives can be made to function in practically any grammatical capacity. It's a versatile word. It's an adaptable word. We find it in songs. We find it in poems. We find it in great literature and pulp fiction. It is inscribed in holy books and on bathroom walls. Love is a word that really gets around. What's surprising is how hard it is to wrap our heads around the concept of love. How hard it is to develop more than just a simple, superficial, facile understanding of it. How hard it is to define love. How inadequate language is in expressing what love really means. Maybe that's because it's been around for a long time. And this ancient love, the song that we played during the offertory, it talks about how love has pre-exists creation, which I think is a wonderful and a beautiful concept. The spiral that you see over there is a symbol of infinity, eternity, and that's exactly how old love is. Love is as old as God. In fact, love, in my mind, is God. An eternal, infinite, creative force that doesn't fit neatly or easily into the confines of the human mind. Go ahead. Okay. So some of these I made myself, and I'm not really a techie. So if they don't work for you, tough. The ancient Greeks had three words for love. Eros, referring to romantic, sexual or sensual love, as in, I love hamburgers. This kind of love is a one-way street. It may be directed at someone or something. It is essentially selfish and rooted in our pleasure. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't have any problem with pleasure. I believe that we were meant to have pleasure. Otherwise, God would never have given us some taste buds. Philia refers to the platonic or brotherly love. It's the kind of love that goes back and forth. We count on it coming back to us. If it doesn't come back, we often stop sending it out. And then there's agape. This is sacred love, bigger than the universe and older than time. So there's a passage in the book of Colossians in the New Testament that compares the building of a virtuous character to assembling your wardrobe in the morning. And I want to underline here that what's important here, or one of the things that's important here, is that it's a decision. We make decisions when we get up in the morning, how we're going to be that day, just like we make decisions about what we're going to put on. And so in this passage, it talks about all the virtues that we put on in the morning. I'm going to be this way and this way and this way and this way. And then it says, and over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them together in perfect unity. Love is the pièce de résistance of our spiritual ensemble. The problem, of course, is that love doesn't go with everything, doesn't fit over everything. I sometimes put on something in the morning and it's too big to go on, to go under my jacket. I have to find something different. So if you're hanging on to the wrong wardrobe in the first place, putting on a garment of love will feel kind of awkward or uncomfortable. It will seem out of place, and chances are you won't want to keep wearing it. There are barriers. There are barriers to love, walls built to keep things out and bars to keep things in. Differences that are hard to understand. In the film, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, two young boys from different worlds are separated by a barbed wire fence constructed by adults for reasons incomprehensible to children. So I'd like to take a look at what interferes with the wearing of love. That doesn't say sham, it says shame. You see the E down on the next line. it's also a word puzzle. This is my own construct. As you see, I didn't construct it very well. But it may be that barriers to the wearing of love are unique to the individual. And if that's true, then I would invite you to take a minute to examine what your barriers are to being loving or to loving. I would invite you at some point, not now, but at some point to even maybe find somebody to share that with. Most people, I think, would name hate as the opposite of love. But A Course in Miracles, which is kind of a new age, well, it's been around for a while, but A Course in Miracles makes a good case for fear as the opposite of love. And just as love is a garment worn with virtues, fear is a garment worn with a particular set of emotions. Hate, shame, vengefulness, envy, anger, to name a few of the biggies. I'm sure you can think of others. Next one. Yeah. Sometimes fear causes us to feel shame. Shame of the harm that we've caused to others. Shame of the thoughts we harbor. Sometimes even shame of who we are in our core. Fear generates vengefulness too. Everybody read this? The cartoon says, this is the third year in a row I'm being audited. Might this have something to do with the fact that I'm your ex-husband? So fear generates vengefulness. Getting back at someone for some real or imagined wrong is likely to perpetuate the conflict and create situations that put us in their crosshairs eventually. And, of course, as we know in Saskatchewan, the best defense is always a good offense. Anger covers a lot of territory, but when it comes right down to it, anger is what we do when we focus on external events and other people and what is happening or not happening that displeases us. The traffic isn't moving fast enough. We pay too many taxes. Our kids won't cooperate. Our spouse won't mow the lawn. We fear being out of control, and in an effort to get control of a situation, anger will manifest as temper, generating fear in those around us and shame in ourselves for having behaved badly. Fear fueled by shame, vengefulness, envy, and anger can be an insurmountable barrier to love. And I want to just add in here, I've worked in the correctional system now for nearly a decade and a half. I've worked with some of Canada's least lovable offenders. And I've had plenty of practice in making that decision to love on a daily, hourly, and sometimes minute-to-minute basis. It is really hard to love someone who threatens you, even on an unconscious level. And while we psychologists can do a lot to help people manage their emotions, logical attempts to disentangle or disassemble our fear can be cumbersome and complex, even futile. I happen to believe that healing doesn't take place in a spiritual vacuum. So, what's the key then? How do we drive out fear? See how complicated it is? How do we drive out fear and make room for humility and kindness and other virtues? How do we make room for love? Well, and the next one. I love the Dalai Lama. Buddhists would say this happens when we choose acceptance over fear. We accept. When we accept the inevitability of discomfort and distress, secure in our knowledge of the natural ebb and flow of the universe, our shame turns to humility. Vengefulness turns to pardon. Envy to gratitude. And when we trust that the flow of the universe is enough to relinquish control of our lives and our world, anger dissipates into compassion. And we are left with the freedom to love as Jesus and so many others have taught us. This, I believe, is the essence of what Christians refer to as God's grace. How did Jesus teach us to love? Well, he said a lot of stuff. But basically, Jesus taught his disciples to love by leading by example. So there he is. This is a cartoon about the Sermon on the Mount, if anybody is familiar with that passage. Okay, here's an idea. You love them like I loved you. Feed them, clothe them, and shelter them, and let me deal with the judging them. Somebody in the crowd says, but what if they're gay or worship other gods? And Jesus says, did I stutter? So he taught us to love fearlessly, without fear of those who are different from us, without fear of the unknown, of the incomprehensible or the illogical, without fear of scarcity or lack, no matter what happens. I believe that Jesus' great lesson is to strive to love everyone. And I want to tell just a little story here. Somebody very pointedly asked me one time if I was a Christian. Are you a Christian? And I said, well, that just depends what you mean by that. I believe, I said, that the essence of Christ's message in the world is a message of love. When in doubt, choose love. And beyond that, I don't think the other stuff much matters. And so if that's what you mean by Christian, then yeah, I guess I am. But if you mean something else by that, then I'm afraid I'll have to say no. So Jesus taught us to love everyone, from the neighbor who mows his lawn at 6 on Saturday morning, to our children who refuse even to get up in the morning, to drivers who cut us off in traffic, to the gay, lesbian, or straight couple down the block, to people of other faiths and other races, to politicians who aren't doing things the way we want them to. And I know I don't want to add something in here. They have a president next door to us, and I see a lot of hatred going out towards him, and I know that hatred comes from the fear that we have. I don't particularly like what's going on down there either, but I think it's still really important to be filling the world with hope and love rather than fueling and fanning the flames of hate and fear that are rising from everywhere, it seems. Jesus loved the unlovable. Tax collectors, thieves, murderers, pedophiles. Everyone. No exceptions. No exceptions. We don't get to decide. Next one. To love fearlessly is a revolutionary act. And it is big enough to free us all. Would you just join with me in a short period of meditation? We are grateful for the unending, unfathomable, and universal love in which we live. May we open our minds and our hearts to a new awareness of its presence in our lives. May we have the faith and the courage to love fearlessly as Jesus, Gandhi, and other great teachers have shown us to do, and to manifest this love, knowing that we are held safely and securely in the palm of love's great hand. Thank you so much for letting me present this morning. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I don't know if I can answer questions, but I sure would welcome comments. Yes.
Terry, I don't want to say that you're not telling me the total truth, but I was talking to you ahead of time, and you are, it sounds like you're very angry at some of the things that are going on in south of the border, and the fact that so much of our political process is controlled and directed by wealthy people. Now, I have great feelings of anger about that. Mm-hmm. And when I get together with other people who are also angry, I love them for being I love them for being angry. And I think anger is a great emotion and a great motivating thing if enough people get together for the right things.
That's a valid point. It's not, you know, I mean, I'm just...
But is anger bad?
I think there's a big difference between being angry at my kid for not picking up her clothes and anger at social injustice. I think that anger at social injustice can be a great motivator, but that anger has to be directed with love. Otherwise, it just fuels it just fuels the war. Doesn't lead to peace, right?
Yes, my philosophy of life has always been summed up by to maximize happiness and minimize pain for all living things. However, I exclude mosquitoes and wood ticks. And I'm wondering sometimes, because people in this world have caused me 100 times more pain and suffering than any mosquito or wood tick. And I'm just wondering, how do you deal with people who are parasitic, who are, they just cause other people a lot of pain and suffering. I this is a puzzle that I've
had. How do you deal with the bullies in the world?
Well, that, bullies is one thing.
Yeah, they're there, right? They are there, and they're not, they do nasty things, and they hurt us, absolutely. Well, the Mennonite in me wants to say, turn the other cheek. I grew up in a home where there were never any weapons. There was never any physical violence. Although, you know, I have to admit that passive aggression kind of got the better of my mom from time to time, for sure. I think that the ideal of love is something that we strive for. It doesn't mean we don't experience other things, other emotions. I think we experience fear. I remember being bullied as a child and feeling afraid to go to school. And I hated that person who bullied me. I really did. Then one day, I can tell this story. Well, then one day, I was in the it was in the springtime, and we were in the boot room, and you know how in the schools there's that sort of thin layer of water and mud all over the boot room, and there was an old woolen mitten in lying in that water, and it was wet and muddy and dirty, and my bully waited for everybody else to leave. Well, I was a little round kid. Well, things haven't changed much. I was this little round kid, and I was always slow getting my boots on. He knew I'd be the last one out, right? And when everybody else was gone, he picked up that mitten and he started flicking it in my face. And I looked down the hall, and there were no teachers in sight. And I beat the living daylights out of that little sucker. And from then on, he left me alone. So sometimes, I guess, you have to communicate and set boundaries with other people in a language that they understand. But I don't feel hate and fear about that anymore. So I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I just know that my day is better when I wake up in the morning and I make the decision to be a loving person, regardless of the vile nature of the people around me. I have people on my caseload who have caused the death of another human being. And some of them, it's essential for me to be able to love them in order to work with them effectively. So, okay.
I was just going
to... We'll just do two more.
Oh, okay.
Okay, we've had hands up all over, so I think Carol's the last one.
I was just going to say I grew up in a comfortable environment, physical and mental. I didn't have bombs dropping on me. I wasn't starving. But you hear all these people. On the other hand, if someone came and robbed and raped and murdered and tortured my family, what's the magic way for me to love them?
I have an answer for that, but it comes up in it'll come up in the summertime under forgiveness and reconciliation. Yeah.
I guess I'll say it again. But I thought that what was on this slide was particularly relevant to comments like the one that Dave made. And others, the underlined portion that we didn't talk about. That's all. I just wanted to draw attention to that.
Maybe I should read it out loud. Peacemaking doesn't mean passivity. It is the act of interrupting injustice without mirroring injustice, the act of disarming evil without destroying the evildoer, the act of finding a third way that is neither fight nor flight, but the careful, arduous pursuit of reconciliation and justice. It is about a revolution of love that is big enough to set both the oppressed and the oppressors free. Okay. All right. I'm sitting down now.